Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsession
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hey, you guys, it's me, Jackie Cation. That's right. First ranger among rangers of the Dork Forest. You're listening to the Dork Forest. The websites, of course, are thedorkforest.com. Just regular dorkforest.com goes right to it. There's familypetancestry.com that goes to jackiecation.com because it made me laugh. Allthingscomedy.com has a Dork Forest page, and that is because that is my podcast umbrella network, and they have a lot of other podcasts on their website. If you're looking for other pods to listen to, a lot of stand-up comics have their podcasts on there. Al Madrigal and Bill Burr, of course, being the most famous. The credits, let's do it. Patrick Brady's going to fix this audio. Mike Rickberg composed and sang the intro song to The Dork Forest. He will sing again his words to the Mexican Hat Dance at the end. And Vilmos fixes JackieCation.com. He will be fixing up the merch page and making everything more expensive. So if it's $25 for a t-shirt with shipping, it's $30. Then that is taken into account that postage has gone up. And yeah, I raised the prices. But it all includes shipping. All the merch, I might as well talk about it. If you go to JackieCation.com on the merch page, the store page, you can get Ranger of the Dork Forest t-shirts, the Dork Forest t-shirts. I'm phasing out the brown ones. It's just going to be green. So, but I have some left in stock and I'm going to bring them on the road. They're all union made, all the t-shirts. They are made in the United States of America by union workers who have dental and healthcare, very glamorous. And so hence, they run big, just so you know, because they're made by union members and Americans. We proudly, I guess, or with some shame, are slightly larger than other people. You can also get all of my CDs. My CDs are available digitally on Amazon or iTunes. You can just also stream them on Pandora or Spotify, but you can buy hard copies on my website. So there's the first one, Circus People. Hard copy includes a QuickTime video from my 2003 Comedy Central special. The It's Never Going to Be Bread, which was top 10 comedy albums of the year in 2010 when it came out on Amazon.com. And my new one, which came out last year, was top 5 comedy specials of the year on Vulture.com, and that is called This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux. This Will Make an Excellent Horcrux is available as a CD, as a DVD, or as a downloadable $10 special on ComedyFilmNerds.com, which I also write movie reviews for. You can get just a download of it. The DVD itself has a DVD bonus, and I can sign anything. I can not sign things. There is a new t-shirt, and it is the Spooky Reading Girl t-shirt, a reference from my act. Okay, other than that, the LA Podcast Festival is coming up, you guys. It's where everybody gathers. And if you're coming to it, go to lapodfest.com and buy tickets and come to the Podcast Festival. It's the weekend of September 19th. If you can't make it, you can live stream all of them for a month. All of the different podcasts are being filmed and then live streamed and then saved for a month. So you can buy them all for $25 if you are not going to be able to make the Podcast Festival and you would like my podcast and everybody else's podcast in the whole world. Mark Maron's podcast is going to be there. Aisha Tyler's podcast is going to be there. Thrilling Adventure Hour is doing one. Paul Gilmartin, who was just on the show. And you can live stream all of it. It's $25 for all of them. You can save $5 if you use my code, which is DORK, D-O-R-K, oddly enough. And then it's $20 for everybody. My podcast is going to be 4 p.m. on Saturday, September 19th. My guest will be Greg Proops. And then I'm also doing Paul Gilmartin's podcast that night where we will open a vein and talk about any sort of mental illness that I might have because he has a thing called Mental Pod, Paul Gilmartin. That's at 10 p.m. All these times are Pacific. Now, when I do the live shows now, I'd make them premium episodes. That's on Bandcamp. So if you go to probably bandcamp.com/thedorkforest, I don't know, there's a link. And there's special their special premium episodes. I think they cost $2 because sometimes the live ones cost money to put up with the audio guy and the travel and the hotel and whatever. Other than that, there's, of course, a donation button on both dorkforest.com and jackiecation.com where you can donate to the show. If you are enjoying the show, feel free to donate. This has been a weird year financially. And so if you like the show, you could donate $10 a month. I haven't made that easy because I don't like regular money coming out of anything. So you just have to remember, oh, I like this show. Here's $10. And I'd love $100 from everybody. That's what I would love. If you have $100 a year, I would love that. And if you have more, God knows, I would love that too. But whatever you like, whatever you can afford, and if you can't afford any of it, that's fine. Don't worry about it. I'm glad you like the show. Talk it up. You can also support the show by buying merch, which we talked about, or using the Amazon banner on jackiecation.com, which is when you order from Amazon. And we all do. I'm almost certain we all do. I know it only works with the U.S. version of Amazon, though. But you click through to the U.S. Version of Amazon. You do your order just like normal. And it supports the show a little bit. And it doesn't cost you anything extra on Amazon. I do stand-up comedy, Jackie Cation does. And there is a tour page on JackieCation.com that tells you where I'll be doing it. It's an exciting time. Feel free to come and see me live. But for the love of everybody and their grandmother, let's get into the dorkdom of the day. Thanks for listening, you guys. Let's do this. Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I'm in my living room with Stephen Brophy. We met from Mr. Jim Wooster, friend of the show, Jim Wooster. Oh, you and your bone spurs. Remember that guy?
I sure do.
Okay, that guy.
How can I not?
How could you not? You can't forget Jim Wooster.
With no.
Like a burned into your cerebellum, that guy. Stephen Brophy.
With every status update makes on Facebook.
Right. They're sometimes inscrutable.
Oh, yes.
I wish you were on Twitter. Because that's where that inscrutability might really take off.
I don't know why he hasn't joined it yet.
Well, I think the commitment of, you know, you're like, he's going to have to, you know, jump over it and go to Periscope or
right.
Instagram or Snapchat or some damn thing.
Oh, he'll never be on Instagram.
Someone was telling me that I should Periscope the Dork Forest and then, because they're gone in a day. Though I don't believe that. I believe that they are on a server somewhere owned by the Periscope
Everything
people.
Is stored.
Yeah, why wouldn't it be? For legal reasons, if nothing else. And
it's
when,
archived in the ether.
Right, and because, you know, when somebody dies, you're like, guess what? I've got these weird videos that Andy Dick posted. I don't know why that name came to, just randomly.
Is he next up in your death pool? Is that why?
I don't do a death pool, but someone was telling me they had somebody in their death pool. I was like, it feels like Doug Stanhope does it. He has a death pool that he runs, that he pays out on.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, he's a very dark comic and enjoys. I'm good. You know what Dr. Seuss said? Welcome to the safest space in podcast, Bill, where I quote Dr. Seuss.
I love it.
Dr. Seuss says, don't be sad that it's over. Be happy that it happened.
Abso-freaking-lutely.
Isn't that a great line, though?
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah, there's nothing
well
wrong with
said.
That, Stephen Brophy. By the way, you are on Twitter, and it's at stbrophy. And it's also stbrophy.com, which is your website.
That's right.
And you are, in addition to being an actor and these things, you're a writer. You've written prose. You've written fiction.
Yes.
And I have in my hot little hand.
Out of desperation, I've turned to prose.
That's, I don't understand why that, I think that that's admirable. It feels like, it feels classy almost, because it's not even a graphic novel.
Oh, yeah.
It's prose, and it's, granted, they are superhero prose books. I've read one of them. I didn't read the other. I read The Villain's Sidekick.
You could probably read the other one while we're talking, and it would be so
eternity
short.
Conundrum.
It's so incredibly short.
It is pretty. It's pretty tight. It's and these are self published, right?
Yes,
that's awesome. Yes. I love.
I mean, technically, they're published by my friend,
who has a publisher.
Yeah, Johnny B. Baker.
Johnny B.
Out
Baker
of San Diego.
Yeah,
Budget Press. But it's the next best thing to self publishing, really.
Right, it's one step up because he has access to people.
Exactly.
Right, and
exactly.
You don't have to find access to people.
Although I think I've sold more books on my own than I have through Budget Press.
Well, I think that's true almost always. Because, I mean, what you do is you get hard copies and then you sell them. And then it's on Amazon too, right?
Yes, it is.
And that is, people should check it out. The Eternity Conundrum, a brief prequel to The Villain's Sidekick, I have not read. Are you writing you said you were writing something else. Are you writing a prequel to the prequel? Please tell me you are.
I'm writing a series of prequel stories called 12 Angry Steps that will tell the entire origin of my main character, Hand Cannon.
Hand Cannon.
How he got his arm-mounted machine gun and his metal jaw and all the other aspects of his character that make him memorable.
That was his thing. That was his thing, the villain sidekick. It's been a little bit since I've read it, but I do remember the metal jaw. Hard to forget a metal jaw on a dude.
Oh, yeah.
And but it's superhero prose.
That's
which
correct.
Which is a part of I have never read. I mean, yours is the only superhero prose that I've read, except for Tarzan and Conan.
Then you don't know what you're missing.
I'm clearly missing something. There's. Yeah. It sounds like it's a rabbit hole of craptastic enjoyment.
Not as craptastic as you might think, either.
Oh, really?
There's actually a lot of really well-written superhero prose, and it's kind of like a science fiction subgenre that's catching on, I don't think.
Yeah, it's even more speculative than speculative fiction.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
And less scientific than most science fiction.
Right, because anything can happen. Because
yeah.
It's superhero prose.
Yeah, you don't have to adhere to all those weird rules, man.
Now, I have read Tarzan, and I have read Conan, one of each, many years ago. I've tried to read them again. That hasn't really held up for me.
But they inspired comics later on, but of course they were prose first.
Right, but I think that are people taking like Superman or characters like Superman and then going back to prose?
Well, that's been done for years and years and years. I remember probably the first piece of superhero prose I ever read was a novel that was published. It was called Last Son of Krypton, I think, and it was published at the same time as the Superman movie in 78.
Okay.
But it had nothing to do with it. It just had a picture of Christopher Reeve on the cover, but then the plot inside had absolutely nothing to do with the movie.
Right, but did it have something to do with Superman?
Oh, yeah. It was Superman and Lex Luthor and that whole thing.
Okay, so I read A Splinter in the Mind's Eye, which was a...
The first Star Wars sequel.
The first Star Wars prose that was unrelated and yet fascinating anyway.
Right.
I was like, when's this movie coming out?
The beginnings of the expanded universe.
It was... Was it? I don't know if it was that
I don't know if it really
ones?
Counts as that, but it was the first Star Wars novel outside of the books based on the screenplays.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Oh, good. Well, then look at me getting in on the ground floor of something I didn't know existed.
See?
But I consider Tarzan and Conan superheroes.
That makes sense. I mean, yeah, they're definitely pulp heroes.
Right.
Which
and
is where
Tarzan can talk to animals.
Yeah, which is a superpower of sorts.
Which is a superpower. He is.
Although in his case, I think it's mostly learned behavior, right? It's just how he grew up. So...
Except a lot of people. I'll tell you something. The natives all grew up. They couldn't talk to animals. Some of them could, but he could. He was the king of the jungle. I don't know if
true.
You know that.
True. And, well, that's because, you know, he was the white guy. They had to defer to the white guy.
It was the worst part of it, of course, where you're just like, I bought all of the Tarzan movies because I did some show where I had to defend Tarzan against King Kong because I love Tarzan. Tarzan was my favorite thing when I was a kid. And I asked Andy, my fella, if he considered him a superhero, and he definitely did. Don't you think that he's, because he could swing from things
and hold his breath for long periods. He's at least as much of a superhero as Batman. Like, he's a superhero through training. He's a normal human who
Iron
has
Fist
heightened himself to
I would say almost Iron Fist, because there is a mystical quality about him.
Although, does he have the power of the dragon or whatever it is that gives Iron Fist his super fist?
He has the power to kill an alligator, which I think means gives him the power of an alligator.
But even Steve Irwin could wrestle those.
Right, but he was eventually killed by one. And perhaps
whereas Tarzan lives on.
He lives on in our memories. Okay, now, I've totally weeded off of your topic, of course, classic.
I would expect no less.
No less. But it's fast expanding, but when did it really start, you say?
Well, I mean, I think... Again, there have been tie-in, you know, people have written Spider-Man novels and Captain America novels and things like that for decades. But my first experience and inspiration for all this was a book that came out a few years ago, probably 8 years ago or so, called Soon I Will Be Invincible.
Okay.
By Austin Grossman.
Okay.
And who I think was a computer programmer. Microsoft guy or something that, you know, was really into gaming and various things. But his first novel was this novel told from the point of view of the alternating points of view of a supervillain who got out of prison and was determined to get back on top. Dr. Impossible.
Okay.
And then from the point of view of a superhero who was just joining she was like a female cyborg type who was just joining a Avengers slash Justice League type of group
team,
and seeing all the sort of politics and infighting of that group. And it was
okay.
So it alternate between those two points of view throughout the story. And it was really clever and funny and somewhat satirical, but without being, it was not a parody of superheroes. It was an actual, like
a fairly, celebration.
Yeah, a loving kind of, you know, you could tell this guy loved comics and loved these characters, and they were definitely like.
But he didn't take
like,
himself super seriously.
Exactly. And which I think is key in general, I think, in writing about superheroes. There's always, it's part of the, in life in general, exactly. But in superheroes, especially, you look at the Marvel versus DC thing, and it's like the Marvel movies, they always have a sense of humor. They always have a sense that they're not taking it all too seriously because they recognize that there's a level of absurdity to all this.
Right. And when they do, it gets slightly flawed. Because there are a couple of movies that take themselves kind of serious that where you're like, well, you're kind of bumming me out.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Man of Steel would be a prime example of like, this is so incredibly dark and serious.
And a little bit
Where's
of Daredevil.
Where's the fun?
Yeah. A little bit of Daredevil in how serious it is. And he is a sad sack. And I know that, you know, Peter David could not make a happy Daredevil for some reason. He would not allow him to be happy. Be happy. I want Daredevil to be happy.
Well, actually, do you read the book now? The
Mark Waid
material?
Yeah. And he's really lightened him up.
Yeah, he's taken decades of his damaged psyche and, like, flipped it on its head. And
thank you, baby Jesus, because it was needed. It was needed. I wanted him
But I love, I think that was one of my first introductions to comics in the early 80s was Frank Miller's run on Daredevil.
Okay.
And I love that Daredevil. I love that noirish.
Didn't he create that noirish?
Yes. I mean,
Frank Miller essentially created the Daredevil we know today.
Exactly.
Okay.
That has then been run with by people like Ed Brubaker and Brian Michael Bendis. And
that's where I got in on Brubaker. And then Peter David and now Mark Waid. But what else is, I know that, who's the guy that I just spaced his name who created Daredevil that you were just talking about? Frank Miller.
Frank Miller.
He is famous for creating several of that, didn't he? Like, what else did
he
write?
I mean, he took, obviously The Dark Knight Returns, the Batman story.
That was him?
Yeah. He made the
Killing Joke, did he?
No, that was Alan Moore.
Okay, that was Alan Moore. Okay.
But it was definitely part of that whole, like, dragging comics into a more adult, you know, and for a long time, adult meant dark and gritty.
Right. And I don't mind that. I don't mind. I like that they're adult because I'm an adult.
This stuff, right?
Right, right. And I'm glad that there are children's books and there are adult books. But there was a Nick Fury. The Max line of Marvel was adult. There was cursing, you know, like I think the first Nick Fury, it was the history of Nick Fury. And he's just in bed. Literally, I think they say, like, he goes, I love fucking, or so. I mean, it was like
that was the Garth Ennis.
Was that Garth Ennis?
Yeah.
Okay, who's I love Garth Ennis.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know who I always think I like? And then I read and I'm like, oh, not as much. Is Jonathan Hickman. It gets dark, but I don't feel the payoff that I want.
I think, I was really into his indie stuff more than I was the stuff he was doing for Marvel.
I have that with Bendis.
Like Manhattan Projects. Have you read any of that?
I did read. Maybe that's where I have the idea that I love Jonathan Hickman.
But I got to a point even with that where I felt like it's just high weirdness that's sort of treading water and I don't know where it's going anymore.
Right.
And at the beginning, I was like, wow, this is amazing. You've got like,
The
superhero Einstein and, Richard Feynman and all these amazing like physicists and
Bendis does the same thing where you're like, it's in an amazing world and the dialogue is amazing. What is happening? Because the thing is, I feel like I'm just living my life next to people at that same pace. And especially with a written word, pick it up. I'm going to need to finish this before my deathbed.
Right, exactly.
And please don't let us die together and then neither of us know what happens.
Do there
next.
Really need to be 500 issues of Powers?
And I look, right, because I do love Powers, but it is genuinely exciting when something fucking happens.
Yeah.
And Powers, where I'm like, oh, thank God. Well, look.
I've also developed, I've noticed a passion for finding books that have already been canceled, that their complete runs have been collected in trade paperbacks.
Okay.
And that, like, Planetary is a great example. Like, Warren Ellis's Planetary, probably one of my favorite modern comics of all time.
I forget about Planetary.
And apparently it was really frustrating if you were reading it while it was being published, because it would take ages for an issue to come out and ages for the collections to come out. But by the time I discovered it, it was already all in print and all done.
Oh, see, because I started at the very end, and Andy would just literally, we would go to the comic book store, and he's like, it's been 6 months. Where is Planetary? Where is it? And it's not. And yeah, so I think you are correct. And it's stuff like, you know, are you reading, have you read Lucifer?
No.
That's the spinoff of Sandman.
Right. And who's writing it? Is it
Mike? It's done.
It's not Damon, though.
No, it's Carrie. Mike Carrie.
Okay.
And it's excellent. And it's really great, and I've recommended it before on the show. But it's
and is that is being made into a television show? I think
it is. I think they took the part where Lucifer moves to Los Angeles and opens up a jazz bar, and they're making that into the, which, by the way, is kind of the greatest arc of it and the most accessible anyway. I mean,
that's an impressive premise.
The overarching premise of Lucifer is almost too big for television. Because it's essentially Lucifer is sick of God's ineffable plan, and that's why he rebelled against God back in the beginning. And then God shows up at hell one day just going, hey, you know, it was part of my ineffable plan that you open hell. And Lucifer's like, I hate you.
Son of a...
Yeah, and he's like, I'm leaving hell. And that's in Sandman when he gives the keys to hell to Sandman. And so, but... In Lucifer, and this is a bit of a spoiler, except for that I don't remember any of the individual stuff, and all of the individual stuff is incredibly well done, so it's not a spoiler. God keeps showing up, going, you know what you're doing right now? That's part of my plan. No, no. It's like having a little sister who's like, no, I, or an older brother who's like, you know, I
meant to do that.
Yeah, I meant to do it. Why are you hitting yourself? Why are you hitting yourself? Quit hitting yourself. It is a great premise for a comic book, quite
that
honestly.
Is brilliant.
But it's almost too big for television, I think. So give him a, you know, and then turn it into Moonlighting.
Did Mike Carey, is he the one who wrote Unwritten?
Yes, yes.
I just read like the first seven volumes of that.
Volumes?
Yeah. I mean, they're slim volumes. It's not.
Yeah, they're. No, I know. But
I was kind of hoping it would end. I was like, oh, it's so good, but can it have an ending?
It did. It did just end.
Oh, it did?
Yeah, because we collected.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so it is done. Finally, it is done. And it was excellent all the way through. As opposed to Why the Last Man, which wasn't that him? Was that
no, that was Brian K. Vaughan.
That was Brian K. Vaughan. Wait a minute. Maybe Brian K. Vaughan wrote Unwritten. Someone's yelling at their iPod right now. Anyway, so, but all of these ones are excellent. And Unwritten is beautiful. Kill Shakespeare?
Have not read that.
Okay, that is, the arc is done. You can read that. that is a finished piece of work. It has begun again with a new arc, and I don't know where the hell it's going. But the first run was amazing. And, because Unwritten kind of reminds me of that because of how literary it is.
Right.
It's written by Smarty Pants, Stephen Brophy.
Mm-hmm.
And when Smarty Pants mm-hmm. writes stuff, it makes me feel smart when I get stuff.
Exactly. And it makes me feel like I'm reading something more than just a comic book.
Exactly.
I'm reading an incredible novel that has pictures in it.
Right. Right. Now let's get back to the actual novels.
Okay.
Because that's the stuff that you got sucked into, a rabbit mm-hmm. hole of this thing.
Right. And the thing is, the other reason that I started getting into reading all this stuff is, well, after reading Austin Grossman's book, I was like, is there any more stuff like this?
Right.
And not only was there, but I got a Kindle around that time.
Right.
And it was cheap. It
right,
was really cheap
like
to buy, you know,
$4 to $6 or something.
Self-published or, you know, yeah, low yeah. end kind of. So I discovered another book called Jim Bernheimer.
Okay.
Is the author, and it's called Confessions of a D-List Supervillain.
Yeah.
And it had a slightly cheesy cover, and I didn't have high expectations. And then I, you know, read the sample and was like, oh, wait, this guy's smart and funny and
yeah.
good and interesting. And I, you know, and I.
Jim Bernheimer. D-List Supervillain.
Yeah, and he's written three of those now.
It's a series.
Origins of a D-List Supervillain, which tells his backstory. And Secrets of a D-List Supervillain, which I haven't read yet, but...
Can you be a D-List Supervillain and not be a henchman?
I think you can. You just got to do the low... You just got to be the guy who only works alone and does
right.
really low-level crap. You know what I mean? Like you, and you only end up running across like the most pathetic
superheroes.
A
D-List superheroes, one
exactly.
would imagine.
Exactly. Yeah. Like All Florida right. Man or something like that.
Great Lakes Avengers.
Exactly. Yeah. That's who I think. Florida Man is a character I'm going to introduce in one of my prequel stories, because you always see those headlines. You know,
Florida Man.
Florida Man loses toe to alligator or whatever, and I'm like, that's Florida Man's got to be a superhero.
Florida Man,
a really
does.
Sad sack superhero.
Right, the sad sack superhero cannot get his shit together and is constantly making terrible life choices.
Exactly.
Because he finds the one sinkhole in town.
And he's in it. And he finds the one guy who's on bath salts.
Stephen Brophy, where are you from?
I'm from Texas originally.
You're from Texas. Okay, where in Texas?
I was born and raised in Houston.
Houston.
Which is why I set the villain sidekick in my hometown.
Oh, so, there you go.
Hand Cannon. Duke Hand Cannon LaRue is also from Houston.
Was also from, and that's where, and that's, stuff goes down, man, in Houston.
Oh, yeah. Big stuff.
It's big stuff.
Big stuff. Big, heavy stuff.
A lot of strip malls being put up and then abandoned and then revitalized. That's
You've
the
spent
story.
Some time there, it sounds like.
Well, I know the story of Houston, you guys. I want Houston to have a better story. Write it.
That's what I'm trying to do. That's what I'm trying to do.
Fair enough. But that sounds kind of fascinating, the D-list supervillain. And how are they? Are they nice pulp length?
Yeah,
they're like 220s?
They're all manageable, probably in the 200 to 300 range, I think. Well, and some of the, you know, like I want to say that, yeah, I want to say Confessions is a good, solid, not short novel length. It's not a novella like mine.
Yeah, because yours is 100 pages, which is novella, right?
Right, exactly.
Okay.
Which is part of why I self-published, because at the time, no publisher was taking novellas, so there wasn't even a point in trying to put it out there.
Right.
Now, apparently, Tor.com is actually publishing sci-fi novellas.
Well, that's exciting.
Yeah.
I've read some Tor authors, but what I like the idea of it being, you know, more... And I know my next question. So sorry. Is it available for children? Would you recommend any of this for kids?
No, my books are definitely grown up.
Well, yours is definitely grown up prose.
There are books out there that are more in the young adult vein that I've read. I haven't read any. I haven't personally read any that are for children. I know that there are books out there, plenty of superhero prose books that are aimed at much younger audiences.
11 to 13 would be fine with.
Yeah.
Okay. And, but the ones we're talking about.
I think the
just so.
Wearing the Cape series, and I cannot remember that author's name, but that's a series of books that's definitely more targeted at a young adult audience, and they're pretty well written and fun. I've only read one of them, but I know there's a whole series of those.
Right. So if you have a kid who likes to read, it might be something that'd be good for a 10 or 11 year old, maybe even.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so. Cause there's nothing too grim, gruesome or graphic in that.
There we go. I like it. But just so people know, the ones we're talking about, these are for grown-ups.
These are grown-up books. Yeah. I mean, they're, you know, I mean, obviously a certain kind of grown-up.
Right. A grown-up who's in touch with their inner child.
But there's like, you know, like my book, it's just, there's adult language, there's
adult,
you know,
circumstances.
Adult circumstances, yeah. Some brutal violence here and there.
Sure.
You know, not gratuitous, not too gratuitous anyway, but.
I'm kind of interested in the Soon I Will Be Invincible one. And it's only about 8 years old, you said?
I think so. Yeah, I think it was published around 2007.
I wonder if it's spun out of sort of a fan fiction kind of thing where people are like, because they're just writing prose. They're like, I can make up my own damn characters.
Oh, I'll just change this guy to. I mean, all these books, you'll always find that, like, you know, there's always pastiche characters, like a Batman type.
Okay.
Like, there's a Batman type in my book. There's or there'll be a Superman type or a Wonder Woman type or a Captain America type, you know, that.
Right. I was going to say, is Marvel represented at all in these types?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Especially Captain America.
Sure.
Because I have a Captain America character in the next book that I'm writing, who's called General Public, and he is stitched.
His name is General Public.
He's stitched together from the members of a single squadron of seven men who were killed in action.
Aw.
So
that's his. That's his origin.
They call him the Suture Soldier.
Oh my God! Yeah, that's that's not for children, you guys. That's going to be for grown-ups. That's mommy and daddy book. Anyway, so what? That one sounds a little too dark for me.
Oh, you'll like it. It's not that dark.
Okay, fair enough.
That's just a backstory bit.
That's just the back. That's just the setup. Yeah. We don't have to watch him being sewn together like Frankenstein.
No, not at all.
Fair enough. It's Frankenstein. There's a kind of a superhero classic.
Is that a superhero book?
He is. Well,
that's an interesting.
He's anti-hero.
I mean, he's become one now. Yeah. I think. Like, there's obviously these modern things like I, Frankenstein. And,
right. And Mike Mignola is writing some book mm-hmm. that I actually, it's the only, it's, there's like one or two. There's a guy named Eric. The guy who writes The Dune. The Goon.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Eric Powell.
Yes.
Eric Powell and Mike Mignola. I used to think I'd read anything. And then I was like, no, I'm done. And so now I'm back to The Goon. And then Mike Mignola has too many titles out. And so I think he might be a little stretched too thin.
That gets a little overwhelming. But apparently he is bringing Hellboy to an end in the whole BPRD saga and everything.
Oh, well, kind of thank God. Because BPRD and Abe Sapien are driving me nuts right now. And I like them. But pad, pad, pad. It's the slowest. It's the pokiest bears in the forest as far as trying to read the damn thing. And then, but he, I, Lord Baltimore, on the other hand.
Which I haven't read.
Which, should continue. It doesn't have to, it can be in that same world. It doesn't seem like it's in that same world. So, and it's, we're back in, it's, he's a witch hunter, right? So, it's, just go with Lord Baltimore for now. And then.
Oh, and the occasional Lobster Johnson story would be okay with me, too.
Yeah, yeah, me too. Me too.
Because I love a good pulp hero.
Right, with claws. Who doesn't love a lobster?
And a leather jacket and claws. What
exactly.
else do you need?
Yeah, I don't know why you wouldn't fall in love with that lady. You know, hey, Kaneki, you got a lot to offer a girl. That's a line from Greece. Okay, so.
I recognize that.
Oh, did you? Good. Anyway, so. Again, I've weeded off of you. Let's get back to you.
All right.
And so what else? What other ones would you recommend?
The Astounding Antagonists was probably one of the most recent ones that I read, and that is also available. All of these are available on Amazon, because that's how I started.
What did you do? Did
Raphael
you just,
Chandler, I think,
yeah,
is the
Raphael
author.
Yeah, Raphael Chandler, that's him.
And that, again, I find with a lot of these that they tend to tell stories, my favorite ones anyway, tell stories about villains who end up becoming the hero.
Okay.
And that's, you know, coincidentally, it's not like that's what I was seeking out, but I've been a lot of the ones that I've found, that tends to be sort of the take that, you
what,
know, these
what,
writers
what
have.
What draws you to the villain that becomes a hero?
For one thing, I just personally, I love redemption stories. I always have.
Do you feel like a redemption story? A little bit?
I am a little bit. I am a little bit of one, you know? It's like I'm in, you know, like I said earlier, that one of my prequel stories is called 12 Angry Steps. I'm a 12-stepper.
Right.
I'm in recovery. I'm, like, you know, dealing with all kinds of issues in my life. And sure. Yeah, so I feel like, you know.
Your addiction, foot sex. And every day that you go by and you don't have sex with your own foot, you think, I win!
Or a stranger's foot. You
one
know?
Day
I mean,
at a time,
like,
my friend.
It's crossing a line.
Exactly.
And, I do feel like, and I feel like redemption stories are just, you know, I think there's something that most people in the culture respond to on some level. You know, I mean, like, and the two things, you know, obviously in action-oriented prose, like redemption stories or revenge stories. I feel like revenge stories have been so done to death.
Yeah.
And that there's something so ultimately kind of empty about the idea of brutal revenge that...
Very much so. I think, yeah, it's almost, it's porny in its, mm-hmm. like, revenge porn mm-hmm. kind of, where you're like, no, you can have those inside your head voices that say, I want to... Use yeah. my car like a bully and bully some person who just made bad choices on the road. Shit happens.
Exactly.
And I did it yesterday. I had road rage and I was an idiot. And then I was like, hey, you're being an idiot. So I stopped being an idiot before anyone
And I see that's where I think redemption comes in.
Yeah.
I think the idea that you can have enough self-awareness to stop the bad behavior.
To stop the revenge.
To recognize the bad behavior and... take an action to change it. That's, you know, in a very small way, that's the idea of, like, redemption, I think. That's where, you know, not giving into those impulses and not being the monster that you don't want to be,
right.
you know, and
right.
feeling like, I'm okay with being the angry monster that, like, flips off an old lady or,
yeah,
you
yeah,
know.
Chases some poor yeah. bastard. And I used to do a joke about how I chased an old woman. It was one of the last times I chased anyone. The joke was, of course, is that when you chase an old person, you catch them. And then I got out of my car. Like, we both stopped, and I get out of my car, and I'm yelling at her. And she, as a sane person, locked her car. And all she said to me was, get some help. And I was like, I'm going to go do that. And I went away. I fucked off and got some help.
This time my enemy was right.
Yes. Yes. And so, I mean, and I think to some extent those redemption stories are the next step in sort of the coming of age stories.
Right.
You know, I mean, everyone loves a coming of age story, you mm-hmm. know, like an Earthsea trilogy or The Chosen. I don't know why those two are coming to mind, but then when you're an adult, you've come of age, you should have your act together.
Right.
But for some reason, you're still a bad person.
Or you've made massive mistakes and errors along the way that you.
So you must redeem yourself. And mm-hmm. that journey, I think every adult should be able to relate to that to some extent.
Absolutely.
That's awesome.
And yeah. I also think that villainous characters who aren't like the interest in examining a villainous character is that they're just more complicated. You know, I mean, a hero about as complicated you can make a hero is he's brooding, you know.
Right.
And it's like, I mean, if you look at Batman, it's kind of pathetic to be like pushing 40 and you're still whining and moaning about your parents' death. I mean, it's a tragedy.
Yes.
But most people, rational people, that woman in the car, in the car, get some help.
Get some help.
Bruce, get some help.
Right. You have a disposable income. And he uses all of his money to make weapons mm-hmm. and toys instead of
terrorize and bully his town.
And terrorize and bully the bad guys who are in his town. And he's also a philanthropist. Nobody's saying Bruce Wayne is not a philanthropist. But he could take the millions that he also spends to create toys and fun. And even help even more.
Yeah.
You know? He can adopt more than one kid at a time, is what I'm saying.
and maybe not train them to fight in the street in the middle of the night.
As a 14-year-old. That'd be great. That'd be perfect, Bruce. Let's talk to you. Anyway, yeah, that was my... And I've had this conversation on the show. What do you think of this theory? I think it was with Joseph... I don't know who it was with. It was possibly Joseph Scrimshaw, where we decided that in the original Batman TV series, Batman's superpower was that he was the only adult in that town. It was like someone would do something absurd or ridiculous or mean, and he would say to Robin, "That isn't okay. Let's go talk to them." And that's what I loved about that show.
He was like Mike Brady in a bat suit.
Exactly. Very much so.
And Greg,
I wouldn't mind that show coming back, even though now let's talk about, you said that you enjoy all of the shows. Are you watching all of the shows?
All of the shows. I enjoy the shows that I enjoy the most. I'm like, I'm loving Daredevil.
Right.
I've watched it twice already. And I think, you're right that it is. It follows the grim and gritty formula, but it captures so much of what I love about that character.
Yeah.
And the fact that.
Doesn't D'Onofrio terrify you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
He
terrifies me in part because he's empathetic at times.
Yes.
You know, and that's a great example of, like, that's a complex villain.
So complex.
Yeah. I mean, much more than most of the Marvel villains have been so far, because we're seeing them in two-hour chunks and they don't get very much screen time.
Right.
But he's a really interesting, full-blooded character, and as is Matt Murdock. I mean, I'm as interested in Matt Murdock as I am when he's Daredevil.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, yeah, I love the writing. I love how smart it is. I love, and then I love that it sprinkles in elements of the fantastic, but it's so organic feeling that when he fights a ninja,
yeah,
or there's a, you know, superpowered psychic child or something, you're not like, what's this doing here?
Right, right. I love that. I think that's supposed to be the Night Nurse, right? Rosario Dawson?
Yes, although it's not.
Her name.
They weren't allowed to use the Night Nurse because apparently she's going to be used in Doctor Strange.
Oh, is she?
They weren't allowed to use the real. So Claire Temple is a different Marvel character.
Okay.
Who they sort of slotted into the Night Nurse type of role.
Who is Claire Temple in? Who is Rosario Dawson, right?
Yeah. And I think she used to be like Luke Cage dated. And, oh.
Luke Cage was he worked the room.
He really did.
He really did
until Jessica Jones tied him down,
finally, ball and chain.
Finally domesticated that man.
Because I was like, she's the Night Nurse, and because I love the Night Nurse, and then they just re-released a bunch of Night Nurse stories,
which I think is so brilliant that they found a way to tie in an old romance comic.
Yeah, which was by the way, I read it and I was like, oh my god! And then Bendis did a cool thing with her at the end of it. Because I'll show it to you after the show, but there's the first six issues. It's like, it's probably eight issues, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a graphic novel, though. It's weird. It's not bound like one anyway. And but the first six are the cartoony kind of Archie kind of.
Right.
You know, three ladies are going to nursing school and one of them turns down. You know, and then the last two issues are Bendis going, no, that woman becomes the night nurse. Which is very sweeping of Bendis. And sometimes that irritates me and sometimes it doesn't. And in this case, I do not mind.
No, I think it's great. I think it's great when they can take a kid. Like, you know, back in the day in the 60s or early 70s, whenever those characters were created, Marvel just put out books. And it's like, oh, let's put out a book that's like targeted to girls.
Yep.
Here's a romance comic about nurses. And then to find a way later to say, no, that's part of our big old universe. I think it's kind of neat.
That's amazing.
And I also wanted to say, I think when I'm watching something like Daredevil, I get a real kick out of then thinking, this takes place in the same universe where we saw Howard the Duck at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy. And I just freaking love that.
Yeah.
Because, it feels like the way Marvel does their comics. It's like, this can be grim and gritty and street level and crime oriented. But Avengers Tower is still right over there. And the Guardians of the Galaxy are still up there somewhere in the stars. And
Howard the Duck is still talking to Spider-Man somewhere in town going, you know what? I'm just trying to make a buck. And because are you reading the new Howard the Duck? It's awesome.
I've heard. Yeah. No, I haven't read it, but I've heard.
It's actually excellent. So I'm reading too many comic books right now. So
It's interesting. Earlier you said something about did these books come out of fan fiction?
Yeah.
And just recently a friend of mine turned me on to a piece of fan fiction that was written by Max Landis.
Who is?
John Landis' son. He's a screenwriter.
Yeah,
I believe he wrote Chronicle, that movie that came out a few years ago, that found footage superhero movie.
And John Landis is a famous director.
Mm-hmm. Blues Brothers.
Blues Brothers
American
guy.
American Werewolf in London and all that stuff. But he had written, I don't know, this must have been early in his writing career, he wrote a piece of fan fiction called Shocker Legit. And it is available you can find it online, and it is about Shocker, the character from the Spider-Man comics, low-level villain.
Okay.
All from his point of view, written very, it was like, I was reading it and there were times when I thought, did I write this? Because it's written in the same, like, first-person, present tense, hard-boiled style.
Yeah.
And it's this incredibly entertaining story where you get to know all about Shocker, and he's trying to become a hero over the course of the story and frequently failing miserably and having brutal fights with Bullseye and his best buddy is Rhino, who seems to be slightly mentally deficient, and he has an affair with Black Cat, and like he becomes buddies with Peter Parker before realizing that he's actually Spider-Man, who he hates.
Okay.
And it's a really terrific piece of fan fiction that he just, I don't know if he wrote it on spec or wrote it for it as an exercise, but it's like highly entertaining, and it's obviously a first draft because there's grammatical errors and there's all these things, but so worth a read if you're a fan of Spider-Man
characters.
You were a fan of Superior Foes of Spider-Man, which is a great run that Nick Spencer did on this book that was all about the Sinister Six, but they only had five members. And it was all from their points of view, and it was another great, like, low-level henchman, very funny.
So do you love Thunderbolts?
Yes.
Because that's entirely redemption-y based.
Yeah. Okay. I love Thunderbolts and Suicide Squad and those kind of, you know, and at least
is
I love
Suicide
them
Suicide Squad the DC version of Thunderbolts,
exactly,
where they're supervillains,
exactly,
but they're trying to go straight?
Yeah. And I think Suicide Squad might have come first.
Okay.
But, you know,
yeah.
As in anything with Marvel and DC, we can do a book like that.
I'm Animal Man. I'm the thing. I'm Swamp Thing.
Exactly. What? Man
stop
Thing,
saying,
Swamp Thing.
Yeah, stop talking to the word thing.
And, now I've forgotten your question.
Oh, no, of course, it's always done like that. I like the, because we were talking about, what were we talking about? We were talking about
all kinds of stuff.
Exactly. That was it. It was four different things. And so my idea is we were talking about TV shows, actually.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a huge
what's
fan. What's the next one?
I'm a huge fan. And I went from not liking it at all to, it's the show I most look forward to every week now, is Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Oh, really? Because you didn't like it at first.
I did not like the first several episodes. I thought it was bland. I thought the characters were dull. I didn't give a shit. And
but that's true with almost every TV show. You got to give it at least six.
Not Breaking Bad or Better Call Saul, where the pilot is like out of the gate. I'm like,
that's
hooked.
True.
I'm
that
hooked.
Is that is true.
But this was like, I gave it multiple episodes. And then I kept hearing, or I started hearing that, just wait for when Winter Soldier comes out.
Okay.
Because these universes are going to tie together and it's going to be, and they weren't kidding. And like yeah. ever since then, that show has just like been heavily serialized.
Yeah.
It's really drawn from all the corners of the Marvel universe yeah. that the movies won't ever tap into. Like Kyle MacLachlan plays Mr. Hyde.
Yes.
In season
oh my
two.
God.
And is incredible. Is
so
incredible.
Everyone, Bill Paxton, people having the time of their lives.
Absolutely.
Which, you're right. In the first couple episodes of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., what I missed most was Coulson's humor.
Mm-hmm.
That dry sense of humor that he showed in the movies. And then it finally came back. And I was like, I'm in. I'll be watching this. I'll be figuring out what the hell.
And once they expanded the cast, and once they turned Grant Ward evil, he's become one of the most interesting characters on the show.
Right. People had a problem with how wooden he was,
mm-hmm.
and it was the Sky character. I like that the Sky character has become so exciting that she's also, I think one of the last episodes I saw, somebody told her to use her powers, and she was like, her earthquake powers? And she's like, said, no, your internet powers. Yeah, use your computer skills because that's why we hired you. And so it was a great, bringing it back
exactly
to something that's real. And
she had that. She had a single take fight scene in past season that rivaled the one on Daredevil. That was
right.
Like,
I felt like the same choreographer, quite mm-hmm. honestly.
And she did all that work, and I was like, oh my God!
I did not know that she did all that
work.
Yeah,
and I was like, that is amazing.
She's very fit.
She's very fit, and she's really grown into the character.
Yeah.
And now the character is Daisy Johnson from Secret Warriors. So
yeah.
It's like,
yeah.
All these things where it feels like, oh, this isn't just some little side project thing that has nothing to do with the Marvel Universe. This is steeped in it.
Yep. And it can be as big or as little as they want it to be.
Exactly.
And that's the thing that I kind of liked about it, is that it was slice of life of the regular people trying to work next to and around superpowered people.
Exactly.
Which is there was some backlash, I think, online about Sky having superpowers because they were like, well, we wanted it to just be regular people. But the overwhelming, everybody else was like, no, it has to. We're in superhero land.
Yeah.
And I was cool with her nobody being superpowered and then just running into superpowered people. And then, his name isn't Fez. What the hell? That's the guy from
Fitz.
70s show. Fitz. Fitz.
Fez is joining the cast in season 3.
Exactly. It's going to be great. They're going to just get stoned and shoot everybody in a circle. But the super scientist thing was where their superpowers kind of clearly lay in the first season.
Right, exactly.
They were super scientists. They could stop superpowered people with weird things. And I like that who's the cyborg that's on the team now?
Deathlok,
losing mm-hmm. all the words now in minute 40. I like to lose all the words in minute 40. But I like that Deathlok is in it. So, okay, what about the rest of them? So what are the Marvel shows that are out? It's just Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. There's Daredevil.
And then Jessica Jones is coming next on Netflix. And
that's
then
right.
Luke Cage is coming to Netflix.
Who
and
is
Iron
Jessica
Fist.
Jones again?
What's her name? Kristen Ritter is going to play Jessica Jones. And Jessica Jones is a character invented by Brian Michael Bendis,
mm-hmm.
who is a...
And retconned back into the universe, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And she was... Originally, he wanted to use Jessica Drew, who was Spider-Woman,
right.
as the character. But they were like, no, we got plans for her. So he created this character. She used to be a superhero. She has superpowers, but it didn't work out for her. So she's now become...
What are her superpowers?
She can fly.
Oh, wow.
She's super strong. She has pretty good powers, but she's just become a regular citizen private detective.
Oh, okay.
And I think like her super...
With certain advantages because she can fly and has super strength.
Yes, exactly.
That'll up your game.
Yeah, but it also has this incredible... It's also a fairly dark story where she has this... she was violated in a very psychological way by the Purple Man.
I am unfamiliar with... So she was like mind raped?
Basically.
And
yeah.
Well, which
and
we know from Star Trek Next Generation
mm-hmm.
is not okay.
Exactly.
It's never okay. Who's the Purple Man?
David Tennant from Doctor Who is playing the Purple Man.
Ooh.
Who is just
wow.
this, he's this psychological manipulator character. I wasn't that familiar with him from the comics until I read
okay.
Alias, which was the title of the Jessica Jones book.
Okay.
But it's a great book.
Someone was just telling me about the
yeah,
Alias.
It's a great story, and I think that if they do it the kind of justice that they've done to Daredevil,
it'll
I have
be
no
amazing.
Doubt it'll be amazing. And it has a female showrunner, which I think is great.
That is great.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. It's there was some hoopla. I guess Gen Con had a panel about women. It was how to write women in comics.
Mm-hmm.
Moderated by Bill Willingham, who writes Fables, who I love, and all male writers.
I heard about this.
And it was too bad, but it was essentially Gen Con said, well, we asked all these women writers, and we asked G. Willow Wilson, we asked all these different writers, and they were all busy. I was like, yeah, I know you're looking for big names, but go down a rung.
Exactly.
You know? Just because Kelly DeConnick can't do it doesn't mean there aren't 30 other women comic book writers. You have Bill Willingham. The room will be full.
Exactly.
It'll be fine. Give those women a chance. Give them an option, an opportunity to be known by people.
Totally.
There's artists, there's writers.
Yeah, because that's just crazy. I mean, that's like, really, if you can't get any women to be on the panel, maybe change the panel. Maybe change do something else. Do a different topic.
Talk about something else. Yeah, because Bill Willingham.
Because that just looks, I mean, in 2015... That is beyond absurd.
It looks bad. And Gen Con, actually, they're good guys who are, you know, it's like a couple of years ago, the guy who booked the comedy for South by Southwest, there was a comedy tent, and he booked Tig Notaro and 31 men, white men. And unfortunately, somebody noticed. And he was like, well, I just sort of picked my favorite comics. And it just, I didn't. And
think.
I didn't think. Right. I didn't think I might want to mix it up a little bit because, first of all, that doesn't even do any service to the 31 white guys that you're doing because nobody's going to remember any of those guys.
Right.
Because it's just going to be a blur of white bearded dudes. And the
guys who look
strip.
Vaguely like me.
You know,
some guys with facial hair and glasses.
Right. Some guys that are thin, some guys that are tall, some guys that are heavier. That's all you're going to see. Mm-hmm. It's just going to be a blur.
It's going to be like the line outside of ASCAT on a Saturday night, basically. It's those guys.
Those nice guys. ASCAT, great show, you guys.
Absolutely.
If some women of color could go to it, that'd be great. Just mix up the line, you guys. You don't get to be on it. Anyway, so I did ASCAT one time 4 years ago, but it was fun.
Oh, it's a great show.
And I passed for white, so it's all good. And I am both Irish and Armenian, which I think are both
non-white.
So
you represented... Yeah, you represented.
Yeah, I remember the there was some.
I'm Irish. I don't think Irish is non-white. Look at me.
I think right. You were almost translucent, Stephen.
Yes,
Brophy.
Look at me.
And but I think I read something once where the Irish considered themselves the African Americans of Europe. 100 years ago, maybe 200 years ago.
200 years ago, that might have been true.
Right, I get what the analogy means.
Yes,
it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah,
now
no longer holds water.
It's, and somebody was also saying that Jews don't consider themselves white, and I'm like, yes, but you could pass for white, so you have certain advantages. And I don't know why we've led to this, because you know why? Because comics address the big issues.
Exactly.
Because they can. Comic books can totally talk about anything, and so can podcasts.
It's all in the book, people. No, it's not.
It isn't. Who's Joshua Guess?
Joshua Guess wrote a book called Next, which is a really terrific novel about a bunch of post-humans, essentially superpowered people, and a government-run superpowered prison, and a huge war where the government doesn't trust any of the superpowered people, but obviously there's a contingent of them that are good and willing to like rise up and be heroes and help.
Right.
And to stave off the onslaught of the bad folk that are coming.
All right.
So.
And that one's a good one.
That's a great one.
Casey Glanders
has a series of books that he just churns them out so fast. It blows my mind. It's
the guy
like
just writes.
Yeah, and I read a whole bunch of them, and then after a while, I couldn't keep up, so I haven't read one in a while. But they're very well written.
It's
all about this character Gail Soane, who is also an ex villain.
Okay,
and it's her big redemption story, and it's also the story of her estranged daughter and another, and it's a slew of really great female characters. And part of the reason he wrote it is he has daughters. And
and he needed to tell stories that they wanted to relate.
Yeah, he didn't see enough stories out there that were catering to young women that would be interested in this stuff. And so,
but this is yet another adult topic, right? It's pretty
adult. It's okay. It's sexy and it's violent and it's
So not your 10-year-old daughter.
No, but your 14-year-old daughter could probably
handle it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. That's cool. And are they all self-published to some extent?
Casey Glanders is definitely self-publishing. I believe Astounding Antagonists has a publisher. Couldn't name it off the top of my head.
Right.
Mike Leon, who wrote Kill, Kill, Kill. I think he has a publisher.
What's Kill, Kill, Kill about?
Kill, Kill, Kill is utterly insane. That is the most, not only would I say it's only for adults, it's only for very specific adults. Like, if you are a fan of hardcore Norwegian death metal, this is the comic book novelist for you, because his stuff is so insanely, almost joyously violent and brutal and mean-spirited, and his characters are frequently just different levels of awful. You're rooting for the least horrible of the bunch, but incredibly well written. I would recommend it to such a narrow group of people because of its
Norwegian
brutality.
Death metal fans out there, get out there. This is the book for you.
Yes.
Finally, prose that really sums up your inner life. I would like to write the darkest book in the world and just call it Inside My Head Voice. And it's essentially just the madness that none of us should act upon. And
open up your skull. If your skull grew a mouth, this would be the book.
Exactly.
That it would dictate.
Wow. Is right. And speaking of which, there's a bunch of very dark, like Gotham. Are you watching Gotham?
I think Gotham, I gotta say, I'm dropping it.
Okay.
And I did make it through pretty much the whole first season, but I really think it's bad.
Okay.
I really think it's poorly written, and it is fan servicey in the cheapest, most
kind of hacky.
Yeah. Like,
okay.
Like it, drags in every, it's like, oh, hey, this guy's gonna be the Riddler. See?
Oh,
this
right.
character is going to be the Joker.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the kids are all like, one's Poison Ivy and one's...
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, and the but worst I... characterization of Poison Ivy. And they even made her name Ivy.
Right.
Not Pamela Isley or whatever it is in the comics, but she's Ivy Pepper or whatever. And it's
right.
like... And it's just everything about it is so sort of on the nose, winky, like... And occasionally it has a moment, but like... There's a really potentially great story to tell there. And I thought if they had taken that first season and made it the story of... Thomas and Martha Wayne.
Yeah.
And then had them murdered at the end of the first season.
Oh, that would have actually resonated.
Instead of
a lot.
Opening with it.
Yeah.
I mean, and it opened with it. It was so cliche that she's wearing a pearl necklace that doesn't get broken, but we still see the pearls clatter to the pavement.
Oy,
of
with
the
poodles.
Alley.
I have cherry picked that show because for some reason my DVR, which has got rabbit ears, sometimes we get that channel, sometimes we don't. So I have half an episode of whatever. So I've seen probably 6 episodes,
mm-hmm.
and my favorite ones are the ones with the Tiny Toons of future Gotham. Like, I like Tiny Toons of... I would rather see that show, Tiny Toons of Future Gotham.
So, like, Little Bruce Wayne and Little Catwoman.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. Little Catwoman. And I would like to see their shenanigans, and that would be more fun for me. But that would have been awesome to actually... Could you imagine if they had done the first season of Gotham where we got to see his parents
and who they are, and we find out that we like them and that they're really interesting people.
We have to truly, like, let's love them enough that when we're 40, we're still mad.
Exactly.
That's
exactly.
That's
where
story.
You see the tragedy for him, for the entire city, for every, and that would be incredible.
Oh my God.
And that's such a missed opportunity.
Yeah. Because now they're in, right?
And then supposedly the show was going to hinge on Gordon investigating their murder, but that was pretty well forgotten by midway through the season, I think.
And, right, he had to.
Just have terrible.
Who is that handsome young man? Who is that good looking?
That plays
actor?
Gordon
is
Ben McKenzie. He used to be on The O.C.
That's it.
And he was on Southland.
Okay.
And
Yeah, because that is, he's a different, we were talking before the show about the handsome actors of 2015.
Right, and they're all named Chris.
That are all named Chris. And then also, but he's a different type. He's a guy that looks like that guy, but he's also super good looking.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, oh, okay, so there's that good looking. And then there's the Captain America good looking, which is also Chris Pratt and Chris Pine. And those guys all have that good lookingness. And they all have the same people who are making them work out. Like they have the same
trainers. The same personal trainers.
So they have the same body type.
Oh, yeah. And even Paul Rudd has it now. I don't know if you saw Ant-Man, but
I did see
he's
Ant-Man.
Got a six pack.
He's got a six pack and he's ripped and like crazy. And you're like, okay, and you want me to be able to tell the difference between these humans? I cannot tell the difference between these humans.
I can tell Paul Rudd from all of them because he still looks like he has for 25 years.
He's John Cusack.
He's barely aged. Yeah. Even John Cusack has aged worse than Paul Rudd.
Right, but
Paul Rudd is almost my age, and he looks like his 19-year-old self. And I'm like,
right, but I think that John Cusack is like 10 years. Are they the same age?
He's John Cusack is my same age, I think. He's like 48.
So him and Paul Rudd are the same age?
Close,
do you think?
Yeah.
Okay, so Paul Rudd might be 4 or 5 years younger.
Yeah.
Okay, so, yeah, because he looks much younger than John Cusack.
Oh, yeah.
And it's interesting that he's Ant-Man. But Michael Douglas, let's talk briefly about Ant-Man, which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
It had the heart. It had a lot of heart to it that I thought the Avengers 2 had went darker and didn't have that heart.
Yeah, the Avengers 2, there were so many things I did like about it. But overall, it was definitely left with an somewhat empty feeling afterwards.
I was like, oh, it's a giant blockbuster. I might as well have been watching any number of giant blockbusters.
Yeah, it didn't have that same joyous feeling I had watching the first Avengers.
Yeah. Or Mad Max.
Oh, the best movie of the summer.
The best movie of the summer.
And who would have thought?
If you have not seen Fury Road, Rangers, get out there.
Absolutely.
Because in the world of, talk about redemption.
I was just going to say that. Totally a redemption story. And totally a story that successfully, I guess to the chagrin of some men, totally successfully shifts the focus of who the real protagonist of the story is to a woman and the group of women that she's protecting, and makes probably one of the most feminist action blockbusters you're going to see.
It was rock star. It was and the guy with the guitar, that's every 14-year-old man-child in the world. There's no reason not to love that movie.
The Doof Warrior.
And if the men's movement was mad about the rest of the movie, that should have placated him. Because that guy was made... it was such a... And I had never seen Road Warrior.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I had seen Thunderdome. That's the only one I had seen previously, but we just rented it from Netflix. We got a DVD. We got a hard copy of a
DVD. What's that now?
Well, it came in the mail.
Interesting.
Right, because it was not available streaming, which we all, of course, have. But so I was like, they don't have Road Warrior. We have to get a hard copy. And he was like, okay. So we sent back the DVD that we had for 3 years that we had never watched. And now we are sitting on the next DVD on our queue, which is the British version of Leverage.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is great. I wanted to see it is called... Did I even open it? I didn't even open it, you guys. This is it's like listening to the
She's
unboxing.
Opening it now.
It's an unboxing.
She's opening it now.
Yeah. And of a game. It is called Hustle. Season 1, Disc 1. And it is essentially what Leverage was based on.
Oh, interesting.
You know how we Americans steal the shows of
and written
of
on
Great
the
Britain?
Written on the paper envelope, this doesn't play.
Oh no.
I don't know what that means.
For you?
Let's examine it. This doesn't...
Written in pencil.
All right. Well, maybe they knew that I wouldn't open it for 3 weeks, and then I wouldn't watch it for 3 years. The DVD looks okay, doesn't it?
Looks fine.
Looks fine to me. And then also, are you reading this Warren Ellis?
I have been reading Trees on Comixology, I do that a lot when the prices go down on the single issues on Comixology, because I only have so much shelf space in my life. And I do really love, I try to buy a lot of trade paperbacks, and even those I'll try to buy when they're used, so I get them for a better price.
Yeah. The Iliad.
At Iliad. I love that place. But a lot of stuff I'm buying digitally these days just because I don't...
There's nowhere to put stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's,
and Trees is really interesting.
It's interesting. It's about giant trees, you guys.
Mm-hmm. Giant alien trees
that have come to the Earth, and then 10 years later, they're still studying it. And then I think at issue 10, we're 10 years further on.
And it's also about, you know, sexual and romantic fluidity and...
Because people are involved, you guys.
Crime and violence and sure. all kinds of cool stuff.
So what would you say? You would. We're at an hour, just so you know. So
that went so fast.
It goes really fast, especially when I eat up a good 10, 15 minutes of your dorkdom. Because it overlaps. But people,
all dorkdom ultimately does.
Yeah, they really do. It's at stbrophy.com. Mm-hmm. Well, it's at stbrophy on Twitter, and then stbrophy.com is your website.
Exactly.
The books are available on Amazon, The Eternity Conundrum, and The Villain Sidekick. Go the villain sidekick first before you read the prequel. Could they read the prequel before
you
they
read? You could, but I think it's more fun because it is a... It's a moment that is significant to the villain sidekick that
right.
is being teased in the prequel, and I think that that makes it more fun to read it after.
Okay.
And you get a little more backstory on his ex-wife, the Dame.
The Dame.
And the Eternity Conundrum is, of course, like my version of, you know, the Infinity War and all those other, like, mega... named
crossover
kind of flashpoint and all that kind of stuff. So I just thought, and it also sounds like the title of a Robert Ludlum novel from 1975 or something. The Eternity right. Conundrum.
It does at that.
So it's like a massive apocalyptic event and he's playing his tiny role in it and gets some unexpected news that changes his feelings about letting the apocalypse happen.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah,
that'll happen. It's the little things that make us stop the apocalypse, you guys.
Exactly.
That is the message of Stephen Brophy, you guys. It's the little things that make stop the apocalypse. All right. Well, I love this episode. I hope you guys did, too. Find Stephen Brophy's work and be nice to each other out
and
there.
Thanks for having me. It was a blast.
You are welcome. Be good out there or have fun. Take care. Bye.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat, my hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh, my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?